I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In the wake of a contentious election season and continued turbulence in Congress and state houses across the country, this last year has been a stressful one, and the majority of Americans are feeling it. Today, we'll talk to Lynette Sparkman-Barnes, Associate Director of UMKC's Counseling Services. She'll share perspectives about why this particular political climate is impacting our mental health at such a significant rate. But first, the tiny Vermont town of Norwich has produced 11 Olympians since 1984. New York Times reporter Karen Krause will join us to explore other reasons for the community's athletic success. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The running joke in Norwich, a small town in eastern Vermont, is that it must be the water. With a population of around 3,400, this village has accounted for three Olympic medals and since 1984 has put an athlete on every U.S. Winter Olympics team except one. Our guest this morning says it isn't the water, but a mindset and lifestyle that have become a hallmark of Norwich for a long time. Karen Krause has been a sports writer for the New York Times since 2005. Her interest in the little town on the Connecticut River led her to write Norwich, Our Tiny Vermont Town Secret to Happiness and Excellence, and she joins us now from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Karen, nice to have you. Good morning.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
How did you discover Norwich and its unusual production of all these Olympians?
I was at the 2014 Winter Olympics covering hockey, and I received out of the blue a reader email saying, I've been reading your stuff from Russia, and I don't know if you know this, but there is an athlete in the Olympics representing the U.S. who is from this tiny town in Vermont that has had unparalleled success in the Olympics. You should check it out. And so I looked up Norwich and did a little cursory research and thought, hey, that does sound like something that is worth looking into. And so I paid my first visit to Vermont, went to Norwich, and was just entranced with what I found.
I was going to say, what were your impressions of the town the first time you drove down Main Street and then around the village green there?
I felt like I had come alive in a Christmas card, you know. It just had that feel to it. But I'll tell you, Steve, I grew up in Santa Clara. On the surface of it, you probably can't get a more disparate environment than Norwich. And yet, on a really elemental level, I felt as if I understood this town, because at the time that I lived in Santa Clara in the 70s, it had a lot of the same qualities as Norwich. It was still largely agrarian, believe it or not. It had not given way to the Silicon Valley Revolution. And there was a very strong communitarian spirit. People looked out for not just their own kids, but everyone's kids. Beyond that, it was the epicenter not only in the United States, but in the world for swimming. And I became someone drawn to the sport because of all of these Olympians in my midst. And so I understood how when you have an environment in which one or two or three people experience great success, it is almost infecting. It's infectious. It makes you feel as if this is possible. You can do this too. If these people get to the Olympics, why can't you? They are from the same community. They are, in many cases, doing the same training. So it really demystifies this extraordinary achievement and almost normalizes it, which is such a gift. I know that I grew up thinking, of course I'm going to go to the Olympics. Two of my first three coaches had gone to the Olympics. It just seemed like something you kind of do before you go to college.
Well, what's the topography like in this town that's produced all these great athletes?
Well, it's very isolated, so it's 2 hours from the nearest big city, which would be Boston. And I think that is part of its charm, and also it lends itself to a tight-knit and community. People have to look out for one another because help and is not necessarily just around the corner. It also has this strange, it's an accident of geography where, because there are not many cell phone towers, because Vermont does not want to detract from its beautiful aesthetic environment, it puts up the minimum amount of cell phone towers. And because of all the trees, cell phone connectivity is horrible there. Hmm. And it's also very hard to get the internet. And so what has happened accidentally is it may be one of the few places in America where you will find people completely untethered from technology. They, instead of going into chat rooms and going on social media, they are actually in physical rooms and talking to people face to face. And I really, at first, it was a bit of a transition for me. I was so used to being able to email someone or text Right. someone and have them get back to me immediately. I would go 1, 2, 3 days before hearing back from someone. And it was very funny. By the end of my stay, I was that person who was slow to get back to you on email and text. But it was crazy. I went to a junior varsity soccer game at the high school, and I looked around me in the stands, and not one parent was on his or her phone or tablet.
Wow.
You just don't see that anymore anywhere.
No, you don't. Absolutely.
And I think that's a piece of it. It's an accidental piece of what makes this town what so special is that in lieu of this connectivity through technology, they are connecting the old-fashioned way.
You know, the very first Olympian that Norwich produced had a father with a concerted focus on his daughters becoming champions. And one of them, Betsy Snite, did. As you noted in the book, their story is something you'd expect to hear today. Summarize Betsy's path to the Olympics for us.
So her father was definitely in the driver's seat. He had health problems that prevented him from being the kind of athlete he would have liked to have been as a child. And so it was almost, another sister told me, the best she can figure out her father is that he was living vicariously through his children in their sports activities. He was an avid skier, and so he absolutely steered his daughters into skiing. And the older daughter, Betsy, took to it. She really liked skiing. She was good at it, and she liked the attention that she received from her success mm-hmm. in skiing. Her kid sister, Sunny, was very talented in skiing, but it would not have been the sport she had chosen. In fact, she had a love of horses and would have been just as happy, much happier, in fact, to just spend her time around horses instead of on the slopes. And so Betsy did experience great success. She made 2 Olympic teams and won a silver medal in 1960. But in the process of becoming a champion, her father isolated these kids. In the summers, they didn't spend time with their friends because they were doing the specialized training regimen that he set up for them. They were pulled out of school in the fall so they could go train and chase winter, basically, around the globe. Mm-hmm. And so when their skiing careers were over, they really didn't have that large social safety net that the rest of the community enjoys. They didn't have very tight friendships, and it really was a sad, it was the saddest of the chapters, certainly a cautionary tale for the Norwichians who followed. And I really, this, their story resonated with me because in the 30-odd years that I have been covering the Olympics, I have seen many Betsy Snipes, people who have put their whole beings into this Olympic pursuit. And even the most successful of them, it's short-term gain, but a long-term loss. They only see themselves as performers. They don't even see themselves as people. They don't have any self-identity beyond their sport. They don't even imagine that they can do anything but their sport. So when they eventually do retire, they're lost souls. I did a story last fall on Michael Phelps, the 28-time Olympic swimming medalist, who told me about the depression and anxiety that he has dealt with. And I understood it because I've chronicled his career. I've seen the more he separated himself from the pack, he was isolating himself and focusing to a degree that not even his U.S. Olympic teammates could match or appreciate. And it has there is a price to be paid for that kind of intense focus and monomaniacal pursuit of a goal, of an end result, if you will.
Karen Krause is my guest. She's the author of a new book on Norwich, Connecticut, that has produced so many Winter Olympians over the years. The book, Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town, Secret to Happiness and Excellence. You know, jump forward a decade to the start of the 70s, Karen, and you get a story that's 180 degrees from Betsy Snipes and the glamour of downhill skiing. This one centers on the often overlooked sport of ski jumping. The Olympic journey of Mike Holland and Jeff Hastings follows what you called the Norwich Way. Tell us about Mike Holland and Jeff Hastings.
So they may not be household names, but they are. Jeff is the highest finishing ski jumper at an Olympics of any U.S. born athlete. So he finished fourth in 1984. Mike set a world flying record in 1985. So these are very accomplished athletes in their sport. They are better known in Europe, where ski jumping is much more popular than they are here in the United States, where in as much as people know of ski jumping at all, they remember that opening montage of the wide world of sports skier tumbleweeding down the hill, which I think prevented quite a few parents from ever introducing their children to ski jumping. But it's such a great story. So Jeff Hastings had already begun ski jumping and was in love with the sport. He shows up on Mike Holland's door one day. Mike was 10 at the time and more into cross-country skiing than anything. He knocks on the door. Mike answers. He says, "Here, I have this pair of skis. I don't need them anymore. You're going to go ski jumping with me." And Mike said he was frankly terrified of the idea. There was this hill in the town called Paul Sample Hill, named after the artist on whose property the hill existed. And the last thing he wanted to do was go down this hill. But
I've never understood how anyone does that for the first time, just for the record. There has to be a first time. And how you do that, I don't know.
And if there is a first time, how there can be a next time.
Yes.
But they're wired a little differently than the rest of us, as I came to find out. And so Mike goes up this hill. He spends several minutes just summoning the nerve to go down. He goes down it. He gets to the bottom, lands in one piece. He said it was terrifying. That was his first thought. And his second thought was, "I can't wait to do this again." So there's a little window into how these guys are wired.
Wow.
But anyway, so they just start ski jumping, and they had some really good coaches in the area that were affiliated with Dartmouth College, which at the time still had a ski jump. And so they kind of Mike wasn't very good at first. He was nowhere near the level of Jeff, but he was just so passionate about the sport. He could not get enough of it. He loved it. He loved everything about those 10 seconds where he felt like a bird in flight. And Mike and Jeff were so enthusiastic about the sport that they got all the neighborhood kids, including their brothers, interested in the sport. And then they all fed off one another. And the next thing you know, you had all of these Olympic ski jumpers. For a while, Norwich was the epicenter of ski jumping in the United States. And the interesting thing, Steve, is ski jumping is not like golf. They can't still do that in their 50s. But what they do is every winter they're involved. They teach the next generation of kids how to ski jump. They are still so passionate about the sport, and they infuse all of these young kids with this passion. They are really involved with the Hanover High ski jumping team. I went to a meet, and there was Jeff taking over the PA system and Mike grooming the hill. So here you have two of the most accomplished people in the sport, and they're doing this grunt work and they're loving every minute of it. And you have to believe that makes an impression on these adolescent kids that they're so involved in this.
Right. You know, Norwich has some inspiring traditions for its Olympians. And one of them I'm thinking of is the send off the town gives to its athletes. Tell us about that. And what does that include?
So the first send-off, of course, was in 1984 for Mike and Jeff, because the townspeople thought, oh my gosh, two of our own going to the Winter Olympics? This will never happen again. So we have to send them off right. So they held a celebration for them. And then it just became a ritual because people kept making the Olympic team. And now Mike and Jeff are very much involved as masters of ceremony for the whole thing. And it's done in a very low pressure, low key, cheeky way, as is the Norwich fashion.
I was going to say, what caught my eye is your detail that often in the crowd is some kid who gets inspired by seeing one of their own as a towering Olympian. I mean,
it really is crazy. So Tim Tetro was at that first send off. He ends up making an Olympic team. Hannah Carney was at a Tim Tetro send off. She ends up making an Olympic team. Brett Heil was at a send-off, and he was the first summer Olympian produced by the town. He's actually a second-generation Norwichian. His father grew up in the town. And he told me the funny story of all the grade schoolers attend these ceremonies, and then he went back to his classroom, and the teacher decided to turn this into a mathematics lesson. And she said, you know, this town has produced all of these Olympians, so the odds are very great that someone in this school will grow up to become an Olympian. And Brett said that every head in his classroom turned and looked at him, because he was already very involved in ski racing and kayaking. And kayaking is the sport in which he ultimately made the Olympics. So I talked to 9-year-olds who said that they were under the impression that this is how you qualify for the Olympics. Every town gets to send one person because that's all they know. You could see
must have been kind of hard when they found out that's not how it works, kids. Yeah,
I know. But by then it's too late. They're already hooked on outdoor activities.
Well, what a great
story. And that's
really,
the whole that's the end game for these parents, is they want their children to connect with nature and develop a lifelong love of the outdoors, so that they're not stuck inside all winter, because as you know, those winters can be long and brutal.
Well, you're speaking to a guy who grew up partly in Minnesota, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
But hardy folk.
Karen Krause is a sports writer for the New York Times. She's the author of Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town Secret to Happiness and Excellence. She joined us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Karen, what a great story. Thanks for sharing part of it with us. We sure appreciate it.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, why is American politics these days producing so much anxiety? We're about to find out. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kratzky. The Oscar nominees were announced this morning. If you want some help filling out your ballot before Hollywood's big night, check out last Friday's show. The film critics gave us their views on this year's awards. You can find that conversation and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the head of Kansas City, Missouri's public schools, Superintendent Mark Bedell, tells us about a new initiative to spark conversation between the district and the community. And we take a look at what it's like to live with schizophrenia. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, 1 year after President Trump was sworn into office, therapists across the nation are noticing an unmistakable trend. Lots of strong feelings generated by one of the most divisive presidents in modern American history. Those who support the president don't want to say so for fear of backlash from those who don't. And opponents of the president report feelings of deep-seated fear, trouble even sleeping, and maybe even trouble concentrating at work. In fact, a poll conducted about the time the president took office by the American Psychological Association found that two-thirds of all Americans felt anxiety over the future of the country. Some call it post-election stress disorder. Now a conversation about how politics is causing a lot of worry in Kansas City and across the land. With us is Dr. Lynette Sparkman Barnes. She's Associate Director of UMKC's Counseling Services. And Dr. Barnes, so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Steve. It's so great to be here.
And we want to hear from our listeners as well. How much anxiety are politics causing you these days? And what is that anxiety doing to you, making it harder to sleep or to concentrate? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So, Dr. Barnes, what are you hearing from your clients these days? I mean, how much anxiety is our politics generating?
Oh, my goodness. Anxiety has absolutely skyrocketed.
No kidding.
Since right before the election and right after the election up until now, currently, people are coming in just basically saying they are more anxious and more fearful. That's the thing, the anxiety being associated with the fear as well. And that's based upon many, many things, anxiety and fear about safety. Concerns, safety for their own personal safety, safety regarding their family. Of course, we see a lot of students here, and so there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen with higher education. A lot of concern about safety in terms of even intersecting identities, race, class, gender, sexual orientation, you name it. We have been seeing it.
Of every 10 people who come through, how many of them would you say are mentioned this in the course of a conversation?
I would say 6 to 7. Out of 10.
Really?
Absolutely. They come through.
That's just incredible to me. And can you describe how this anxiety is manifesting itself? I mean, is it trouble sleeping? Is it trouble concentrating? Is it all the above? Or?
Oh, my goodness. It's all of that. Sleeping, concentrating, even physical symptoms, stomach upset, heart. Panic attacks. We're hearing more about panic attacks. Even people are being anxious about even being in class, not knowing how to talk with their peers, not knowing how to talk to professors. Of course, they're anxious about what's going to happen here on campus. It's just any type of symptom that you can name. That's what people are experiencing and in many, many higher levels now.
If you listeners share some of this concern, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCU. Are up to date. We're betting that maybe some of these feelings are fairly broadly felt. So give us a shout, 816-235-2888. So, Lynette, why is our politics creating so much anxiety here? I mean, what is it that induces all these deep feelings?
Well, really, it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, our students and faculty and staff, the people that we see here are just like everyone across the country. And so they're experiencing that hesitation and trepidation that goes with changes in administration, that goes with especially a type of politics that's been so very divisive, as you said in the introduction, that is so overtly aggressive, and platforms that were run on very much aggressive types of things. And so people, of course, are concerned. We have a lot of international students here who are very much concerned about their families. We have students that are from other countries that won't even go home now. They can't go home to visit their families because they don't know if they're going to be able to get back into this country. And I can't even imagine that. You've been here this long to study, but you're not sure because now your country's maybe on a list where people cannot come back in. And so you can't even go home and see your parents. or perhaps your spouse or your children, because you don't know if you can even come back to this country.
And then, of course, the Kansas City area suffered through that incredible tragedy a year ago, roughly, out in Olathe, where,
yes.
where a UMKC student was, yes. was shot, and mm-hmm. that's caused a lot of concern.
Absolutely. And people are very much aware of that around here. This is a very close community, but the anxiety and the fear actually is sparking a little bit of, you don't quite know who to trust either. That's what anxiety can breed to, is distrust. Plus, we're hearing a lot more from women who are so very much concerned about their own personal safety, not even necessarily about women's rights and reproductive rights, but even just their own personal safety. Mm-hmm. In the backdrop of comments and things that we hear about sexual assault, and so people are very much concerned, and even those who have daughters, sisters, people are just very much concerned about that. Anything related to race, to gender, to class, to nationality, to religion, to immigration status, we're seeing it.
Does all this fall at the feet of our president, or is it broader than that? What do you hear from people?
Basically, it has been very much attached to this administration and this mm-hmm. election. Mm-hmm. These are issues, of course, we know have been far and outstanding for quite some time. But there has been a shift where perhaps even some people have had identities that have been more privileged beforehand, but now are in greater jeopardy. And so we have now this kind of outpouring. People are speaking out because it is affecting families that it perhaps wasn't even affecting before.
Lots of phone calls. In fact, a full board of phone calls here as we talk about the anxiety that so many folks are feeling in American politics these days. 816-235-2888. I'll clear a couple lines here in just a second. Rick from Independence, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
What has you riled up here, Rick?
I've never known anxiety in my lifetime. I'm a senior citizen. And I know it now because of fear of those that are occupying our Pentagon, the cabinet, and of course the White House, and fear of provocation of nuclear war.
So you worry that that actually could happen?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
If not provocation, by accident, because of the mere fact of who these people are.
How does that anxiety manifest itself with you, Rick? Is it trouble sleeping, or what is it?
Well, it's just a state of mind. I'm not excited about the future. It's sad. I can't be excited about completing my life's projects of helping create a better planet, a society, a more durable future.
Lynette, what would you advise Rick, hearing him talk? I mean, what things might help him move forward here?
Sure. Well, of course, you know, I can't do teletherapy or anything like that. I can say, Rick, I certainly hear you and understand where you're coming from. The fears that you're expressing are fears that we continue to hear. You're talking about a specific one about military action. You're talking about the nuclear action that could be taken. What I'm really zeroing in on is your sense of hopelessness, just no hope for the future. And that's something that a lot of people are experiencing. So I want you to know that you're not alone in that. But I also want you to know that together we can weather these storms. We've been through many storms before. And so please take heart and be encouraged in that you are not by yourself.
I hope that helps, Rick.
Well, I have a different viewpoint, and that is that we simply must, all of us must act and resist and get these people out of office. They have no business in our government.
Rick, thanks. And political activism, mm-hmm. activism is sort of seen as a remedy to some of the things that Rick is feeling in some
Absolutely.
Cases.
With the hopelessness that he's talked about, one thing that I've seen that is a wonderful thing is actually a new generation of activists, people who are actually speaking who didn't speak before, people who are finding their voice who thought they didn't have a voice before. And activism can look many different ways. It doesn't have to be you standing at a protest. Activism could be you volunteering at a local shelter. Activism could be you just having a conversation with your family about what's going on. Activism, like he said, just act in some sort of way.
How much anxiety are you feeling as a result of American politics these days? 816-235-2888. Let's go to Murad from Harrisonville. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
You bet.
And I do feel a sense of anxiety. And one of the things that, well, actually two things that really is troubling to me. First of all, that truth and honesty are becoming less a reality for us. Now, I'm an African-American man, and I have other cultures in my genealogy, but I had to endure a whole lot of things that people act like was not going on. So I endured that, but it's even worse than when it was as I was growing up. And the second thing is that our sense of humanity, having compassion for another human being. Now, your guest talked about activism being going out and helping people and doing those kind of things. I've done all those things. I've stood on picket lines, held picket signs, helped AIDS, raise funds for AIDS research.
Does it help?
Of course it helped. It did help. It helped me to feel like I contributed something to the greater good of humanity every time I opened the door for someone or I helped someone. That made me feel as though I contributed, and I wasn't just trying to take from the world, but I was giving something good to the world.
Right.
Because it wasn't required that I did it.
Okay.
But if everyone acted this way, we would be better.
Murad, I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for sharing with us. I appreciate that. And let's go to Jan here from Kansas City, Missouri. Jan, you're on Up to Date.
Hi.
Thank
you for talking to me today.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think my greatest sense of anxiety has been caused by the treatment of so many vulnerable people. I've traveled a lot in my lifetime. I have a lot of respect for other countries, their people, their cultures. And just to see that attacked in so many ways has just really been devastating to me. Just when I think everything might get a little bit better, then it seems like there's another slam towards, you know, even the elderly, the children. I'm a nurse. I'm a caregiver. I'm very empathetic. So I probably pick up a lot of those vibes just from my, because I am so empathetic. But that's probably what's caused the most anxiety for me.
Okay. Hey, I'm glad you called. Thanks, Jan.
Sure. Thank you.
You know, some anxiety I've read, Lynette, is usually regarded as normal and helpful. So maybe the question is, how much anxiety is too much anxiety?
Mm-hmm. That's a really great question. I think a lot of people experience too much anxiety, like talking about not being able to sleep, disrupting your concentration, not being able to work, things of that nature, especially the physical symptoms of anxiety. But we do need some level of anxiety, some level of stress. There's a maximum level that actually causes us to act. And so it's that level that actually causes you to get up, to move, to do something. It doesn't take you to the other side where you're pretty much immobilized, but it basically angers you enough, or it inspires you enough to move and to do something. Mm-hmm. Both of the callers that we just had were talking about acting in some sort of way and compassion and connecting to others. And they're really on the right track with that. That really helps with anxiety. So much anxiety is about not having control.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's what this has been, especially with this election. People feeling they have no control of what's going on, what's going to happen to them, no control of what's going to happen in the future. And so by acting, by connecting with others especially, that's one way that we can have some control about our situation here.
You know, I'm wondering how sticky a wicket this is for therapists themselves, because this issue is so charged. Mm-hmm. Our political environment these days is so loaded, mm-hmm. that you read about, you know, therapists themselves struggling to deal with patients and clients unless they actually tell them, yeah, I agree with you completely, or connect with them in some way. You know, so the big question for therapists, do they have to validate their clients' feelings, and do they, without wading too far into politics, or how do they navigate that these days?
It's a fine line to walk, because, of course, we can't bring our politics into the room with
anyone. You're not supposed
anyone.
To, right?
Exactly, exactly. However, we all have particular values, and we all pretty much govern ourselves and our lives in a particular way. I can speak quite personally to that as an African-American psychologist. It's been hard to sit in these spaces is at times, depending on what people are saying to me. But this idea of being able to connect to another person, even if I don't necessarily agree, just based upon my personal governance and my personal right. belief system, even if I don't agree, to be able to somehow connect with that person, have that compassion in that moment and offer that grace in that moment has been a big help for me.
But some therapists I've read have actually sort of thrown in the towel mm-hmm. and told their clients, yeah, I can't hide behind this. I'm with you.
Absolutely.
You know?
And if you're doing that, I can certainly understand why that is, because people have to understand that this affects the health care, the health givers as well, not just everyone else, those who are coming to see us. It affects us as well deeply. We all have families. We pay taxes. We have health insurance concerns just like everyone else.
Leslie from Mission Hills, we're talking about anxiety in American politics these days. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Great show. The anxiety, I think, is heightened by the level of chaos that the current times are elevating. And that chaos, I think, fosters this feeling of having less hope. And for me, that was motivation to really concentrate on what we can do. And I really can't add to all the great things that your guest has been saying, because she's hit the nail on the head. But it was part of why I became involved with Indivisible KC. And for people who don't want to be overtly political in that sense, there are other ways. The Poor People's Campaign and the Moral Revival Movement is being brought to Kansas and to Missouri as well. So there are lots of ways. If it feels uncomfortable to be overtly political, but the issues touch on those moral compass points for individuals, the way to combat the hopelessness is, hope is actually an expression fulfilled by an action, and you can find a lot of ways to do it.
Leslie, good call. Thank you. Let's go to Jack from Shawnee. Jack, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, good morning. This is a good show. I'm feeling quite a bit of anxiety as well, particularly about the safety social nets, cutting taxes for the rich and corporations. But Medicaid, Medicare, looks like they're going to be up for cutting, so it's very disturbing. I went to the Women's March on Sunday, and that helped, being around other people who were positive and seeing it and trying to create positive change is really a really good thing. But it is anxious producing.
All right, Jack. Thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it, Chad. Ann tweeted this, absolutely seeing a spike in anxiety over the last year, and many of my clients are talking about the political situation as a stressor. So, again, so much of that out there. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank, though, Dr. Lynette Sparkman-Barnes. She's Associate Director of UMKC's Counseling Services. Did a great job, Lynette. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's time now for State House Blend Missouri, KCUR's weekly political podcast. This week, host Brian Ellison talked with a now former senator who hasn't stopped yet thinking about what's going on at the State House.
From KCUR Studios, this is State House Blend Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. It's a weekly podcast where we bring you the politics and policy that's happening at the Capitol, where we meet the people making the news and figure out why it matters for our lives. This week, we're talking with the state's newest ex-senator, Ryan Silvey, newly enshrined as a member of the Public Service Commission. Today, something of an exit interview with this Republican who often clashed with a governor, who just a week after nominating Silvey to the new post, found himself very much on the rocks. Commissioner Ryan Silvey, welcome to State House Blend.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here. And also joining us is my KCUR colleague, our morning newscaster, Kyle Palmer. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. So, Commissioner Silvey, do you miss the Senate yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it all happened so fast, and I didn't really have a whole lot of time to fully process the decision, but, four of the five commissioners are former senators, so I've got plenty of support to lean on.
I mean, you say it happened so fast. How fast did it happen? Were you told you have 72 hours or something to make
no,
a decision?
No. So apparently, I think it's the fastest in history is what we've been told. And then literally they appointed me Tuesday night and I was confirmed Thursday morning. So 40 hours, I think, from appointment to confirmation.
Yeah. What In what state do you feel like you're leaving the General Assembly and the Senate, concerning what's happened over the last week or two?
Well, certainly that all happened after I was was confirmed. So that was a shock. They're gonna figure it out. You know, I mean, there's not a whole lot that normally goes on the first couple of weeks of session. So it hasn't been a huge distraction probably yet because there's not a whole lot going on.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, were you a little surprised? You and the governor have, as has been well reported, have had your differences.
Sure.
You've talked about them here. Why do you think he asked you to do this?
Sure. I mean, I was surprised as anybody. I mean, it's not certainly something I'd asked for or pursued. You know, I think there's a couple reasons. One, while the governor and I have clashed on a number of areas, energy policy is not one of them. And having been chairman of the Utilities Committee, when that term expired of Commissioner Stoll, they were looking for someone to replace. And you know, I would like to think that my skill set played into part of that decision. But clearly, I think that part of it, too, was because I had been such a thorn in the side, that if I would accept this and move over, then that's one less distraction for them.
And why did you say yes? I mean, you loved, if I may say so, you loved being in the Senate.
I did. You know, term limits is a big part of it. I had 3 years left to affect public policy in the state. After that, I could have run for various things, but those are always a coin flip at best. I mean, you're never guaranteed to win any race that you enter. This is a six-year term. It's an area of policy that I'm very interested in. I think it's a rapidly evolving sector of the economy, and it essentially doubles the time that I'll be able to affect policy.
I will say, I mean, I've read some interviews with you immediately after the appointment and the nomination. And you kind of shifted away from, you know, any kind of reading into why the governor would have appointed you or asked for your nomination. But it seems now that, I mean, you're kind of at least admitting, at least that's part of the reason, right, that there was those clashes between you and the governor, and that played a role.
I would imagine. I mean, they never told me that. But, I mean, I've been around politics long enough to know that it would be advantageous for him to move me out into a less visible position. I guess not a lot of media running to the public service commissioner to ask for his opinion.
Might now.
So. Well, and to that end, I mean, do you feel like you owe the governor anything? I mean, the appointment was made. Your interaction with him doesn't have to be any further, I guess.
Yeah, no. I feel very independent in this position. I mean, it's a six-year term. You know, so even if I were wanting to be reappointed to it, which is pretty rare, most commissioners are not reappointed. It's kind of a one-term thing. You know, that's 6 years from now. He may not even be governor. I don't see any reason to feel indebted.
Well, and of course, there are those who wonder just how long he will be governor, even in much shorter terms than that, as we already heard. A number of your Republican colleagues, some of your former colleagues, are calling for the governor to resign. Knowing what you know, do you think he should resign?
You know, I think in the time that I've been in office, people have resigned for less. But that's, you know, obviously an intensely personal decision that he will have to make. I don't think having the cloud of scandal helps the party in any way. It certainly doesn't help those that are still in the legislature trying to write law. You know, I think it has damaged his credibility, and it's hard to lead when you have damaged credibility. Not that you can't ever rehabilitate that, and you know, maybe that's what he'll do. But at least in the short term, yeah, it's hard to lead when people don't trust you.
It sounds like if you were still in the Senate, you would be urging the governor to resign.
It's possible.
Fair enough.
Do you have any reaction or surprise at how your GOP colleagues have reacted, yay or nay?
No, not really. It doesn't surprise me that you know, a handful of members of the House have called for his resignation.
Including some of his big supporters. They don't all have the same relationship with him that Rob Schaff does.
Right, sure. Nate Walker was one of his big supporters during the primary. you know, Marsha Hafner is a very well respected member of House, particularly in the appropriations process. So is Kathy Conway. It doesn't surprise me that they would come to that conclusion. But again, they also have served under speakers who were forced to resign for less. So
the harassment of interns, for example.
Yeah, it's not surprising to me that some would come to that conclusion.
Yeah, do you feel? I mean, you worked in the General Assembly in a time when there were those scandals. Before this latest thing happened, did you feel like there was any type of evolution in the Capitol, that things were getting better, that there was something that like maybe the cloud that had been over Jefferson City for the last couple of years might have been lifting before this latest incident?
You know, yeah, I guess. I mean, the last couple of scandals that popped up were resolved quickly. I mean, they both, within a matter of hours or days, stepped out and everybody moved on. So it was a shock. I mean, I don't think anybody – I wasn't expecting this to come out about the governor, certainly. So, you know, he'll deal with it how he's going to deal with it, and everyone else will just try to do their job.
You have mentioned here that you sort of – You put up with the politics to be able to write policy. Is that a permanent move away from the elected realm? Obviously, your political future was a frequent source of water cooler conversation around the state. You were talked about for the Kansas City Council, maybe for mayor. That's obviously all on hold this time around.
Sure.
Is that something you might still consider someday?
Yeah, I mean, certainly down the road. It might be a consideration, but it's not a plan. You know, I frankly never really had a plan. When I got to the House, I could look out far enough to see that my senator was going to term limit the same time I was. That was probably the closest to a plan that I ever had. Yeah, I mean, if the opportunity to serve was right and it was something that looked interesting to me, I would never rule it out in the future.
My thanks to KCUR's Kyle Palmer for being here.
No, thank you. No problem.
And, of course, thanks to Public Service Commissioner, former senator, former state representative, but now 6 years ahead of him in the Public Service Commission, Ryan Silvey. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And I have one more question for you. Perhaps for the last time for a while here on State House Blend, I would love to hear one song that you think captures this moment in Missouri politics.
Ooh. See, now capturing the moment throws a curveball.
All right.
For encapsulating the moment, though, it would have to be a retread, because I always feel like Stuck in the Middle by Steeler's Wheel is where I'm always at.
clowns to the left of me
and jokers to the right.
It's always a good choice, too. We're going to go with that. We're going with Stuck in the Middle. Senator and Public Service Commissioner Ryan Silvey, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
State House Blend is a production of KCUR Studios. We've had help this week from Chris Young. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I'm wondering what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. Losing control, yeah, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
You can hear the entire episode of State House Blend Missouri and Ryan Silvey's thoughts on the governor's plans to cut taxes at kcur.org. Tomorrow we look at living with the oft-stigmatized mental illness schizophrenia and a conversation on the relationship between Kansas City School District and its surrounding community. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.